Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
University in Washington, D.C., a collaboration between the American Bar Association's Energy, Environment, Markets, and Finance Committee and the Washington College of Law. This is the Hot Air Show, your source for insight and opinion on clean energy and carbon policy, politics, and markets. I'm your host, Chris Barrett. On today's show, we're going to look at everything that happened in Durban during COP17, ask our panelists, what does it mean for the domestic markets here in the United States and abroad, and are we really heading towards a legally binding endpoint sometime in the next 10 years? Before we get going, let's have our panelists introduce themselves.
I'm Wiley Barber with GAMCO, a project developer globally.
Carol Muffett, president of the Center for International Environmental Law.
Lisa Zelliot, editor for North America, Point Carbon, Thomson Reuters.
Bill Snape, Center for Biological Diversity and a fellow here at the Washington College of Law.
I'm Kevin Book. I'm a research analyst at Clearview Energy Partners.
Carol, from your perspective, was Durban a success? Did we have more than an agreement to agree in a binding fashion at some point in the future?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define success. If you define success as the absence of complete failure, then Durban was a success. But what Durban did was pull together an agreement that largely kicked any meaningful decisions down the road in terms of the form of any future agreement, the content of commitments, the money on the table. Really, by and large, Durban was a decision to decide again in the future.
Interesting. Did you see that can starting to kick all the way back to Bali?
Can you rephrase that?
In other words, with the Bali roadmap and what has come since, I mean, the process has been characterized by many folks as the can continually being kicked. Is this just an extension of the same with a bit more construct around it?
There is movement forward in the narrow terms of this process, the recognition that everybody is going to take some sort of obligation of some sort of legal nature as yet to be defined. You have to recognize that as a movement within the confines of this process. And there was movement forward on setting up, for instance, a green climate fund. Unfortunately, they didn't actually agree to any money for the fund. And while they agreed to, you know, that they would at some point agree an outcome of some legal nature, they didn't define what that is. And so is it progress in the narrow terms of this negotiation? Yes, arguably so. Is it progress in terms of what we need to do to address the challenges facing the planet? There's no way you can look at this and see progress on that scale.
A metaphor that I've heard to describe what you're saying is empty vessels. The whole thing resulted in a lot of well-constructed vessels that are somewhat solid, and they've all sort of figured out how to structure things like the Green Climate Fund, like the potential registry for pairing NAMAs, nationally appropriate mitigation actions, with funding for those NAMAs. And the whole legal agreement itself, there's sort of some sort of framework for it. But none of those things are full of anything. There's no money for that well-constructed fund. There is no clear target or timeline for the potential agreement. So it's a sort of constructing of these things that are actually empty and therefore perhaps not very functional.
I think that's right. And for instance, we saw the renewal of a second commitment period for the Kyoto Protocol, which, although it's unpopular in the United States, is important to most of the rest of the world. But we still haven't identified the content of the commitments for that second commitment period. And it's not clear what happens after 2017, after 2020, when that second commitment period expires.
And very importantly, most of the countries of the world are not taking on commitments in that second commitment period. It's just Europe, which was going to do it anyway through its phase three of its emissions trading system, and potentially Australia and New Zealand, although they only sort of partially signed on, depending on what other countries do. So the second commitment period is kind of just there to continue the CDM and the flexible mechanisms, too.
Well, it sounds like there has been, from your perspective, some appropriate titling, and we've had the use of ad hoc working groups around commitments for some time now in the process, and it seems like while we've added more structure to them, we're continuing in ad hoc fashion, and they are going to be marching into the future, meeting after meeting, trying to deal with these commitments. However,
a lot of folks are putting emphasis on the fact that this was the first time where there was an understanding amongst the parties that folks circled around that there needs to be a understanding climate equity issues. There needs to be an even level of commitments among all emitters going forward. This isn't to say that the issues that Russia has with hot air and wanting to keep their assigned allowance units, the issues that you found in a number of different forums, OASIS, the small island states, but there's always been this big divide between the least developed countries and the developed countries on this. That divide has seemed to have closed more significantly than it has before. At least that's the way some people are trying to portray it. Do you feel that that's the case? Bill, did you get any sense that any of the climate equity issues were dealt with?
I know the admonition was to be cheery in this holiday season, but no, I saw, as is the title of this show, a lot of hot air. I did not see any tangible progress on equity. I didn't see any tangible progress on anything. I saw some rhetorical openings by some countries that didn't materialize in anything concrete in any document that came out of Durban. The Durban platform is a bunch of political rhetoric, and nothing's going to happen, it seems to me. I mean, this is my take home from today. Nothing is going to happen until the people demand something to happen, which of course is difficult in a world context, and I think it's going to start with the United States. I think nothing is going to happen until the U.S. decides it wants something to happen. And at this point in time, it's pretty clear the U.S. has no interest in any type of meaningful agreement.
What did folks see as the U.S.'s role during Durban? There was a lot of mixed reports coming out about, you know, what Todd Stern was saying here, where we were positioning there, were we being obstructionist, were we coming along? It seemed like a mix of reports. What's the sense that you guys had over the role the U.S. played? Were we a leader? Were we a lagger? Did we kind of just go with the flow?
Chris, I think the message that came back from everyone I talked to is that we were saying, we're with you in spirit and in no other way. We don't have the wherewithal at home right now. We've got an empty gun, so we're not going to draw it. I mean, if you talk about, you know, analysts usually look at trends and talk about the derivatives of velocity, acceleration, jerk. The derivative of idleness is perhaps what we have here. I mean, we had a lot of focus on things like the bindingness of future obligations, not the obligations themselves, but the extent to which they would be binding. Here's where a strong international arbiter steps in and says, we have frameworks of law, people. They're binding. Did the U.S. do that? No, of course not. The empty gun stayed in its holster because it had to. It was a tough time, I think, for probably the delegates from the U.S. in that they had such a strong hope for activism going into Copenhagen and had to essentially stand by the wayside and watch nothing happen this year.
Well, you could argue that the impact was, you know, pretty negligible in terms of our participation, but a lot of folks still did point to the United States and say, you know, you need to be a major leader, you need to have a role. Do you guys see politically here in the U.S. us being able to evolve from shooting climate change legislation in gubernatorial ads to being able to actually consider the passage of some meaningful binding commitment as part of the second commitment period?
Let me be an optimist. To follow Bill's echo of your admonition.
Please, it's the holidays, folks.
And I see it on the international stage, and I see it everywhere but in Durban, and in 9 days it flies across the ocean on a plane. We're in a long, slow process. For those of us who first looked at the global trade implications of climate when the Duma approved Kyoto in November 2004 and said, ha, this is going to be a trade war. That'll be how we price carbon. People, I think, Chris, in your realm and Bill, probably yours, said, that's the very worst way to do it. And you know what? I agree. It is the very worst way to do it. It's also a way to do it. And where we are now globally, as nations are seeking competitive advantage, where we're looking at factor cost disparities, as an emerging economy becomes a dominant player, this is actually where this portal opens up. For the U.S. to come back to the table, we have to have a reason. And the reason is a small part of our economy just got more expensive. And it's our best friend that said they would never tax us that is. And this is actually not a bad thing in the sense of looking at the climate frameworks evolving. It would have been a bad thing if it had been how it started, but for things to end, this is the ember from which I suspect the fire may be relit.
Well, Kevin's referencing the decision by the European Court of Justice recently, just a day or two ago, with upholding the inclusion of airlines, air transport, within the next phase of the European emissions trading system.
And in particular, international.
In particular, international airports, which has in particularly rubbed the wrong way a lot of folks in D.C. who look at this as, you know, an infringement on sovereignty. Interesting enough, you have not heard many of the trade aspects or the trade sabers being rumbled here specifically around it, more around the sovereignty issue. But this is an interesting one. You know, back to the original question about the politics swelling here in the United States to actually get a commitment so that we have something to bring to the table in 2015. Do you think that basically an added carbon tax for business travelers and Americans who are well-heeled enough to fly over to Europe at times is going to significantly impact the political situation we have here in the U.S. around climate change?
All I'm suggesting is that the trade issue is a thing that people want to have smoothed. Mm-hmm. In the United States, cap and trade looks like a cost, but trade looks like an opportunity. And so it is a reason for the many people who've absolved themselves of thinking about this to suddenly have to think about it again and to look back at efficient ways to broker the exchange of goods, including, dare I say it, markets.
What I hear Kevin saying, and he'll correct me if I have this wrong, and I agree with him if this is what he is saying.
Weird, isn't it?
It is. but you're making a very important macro point that I'm going to state differently to see if you still agree with it, but I think that I agree with, which is that what we've seen in Durban in these international conferences, all of which have been certain forms of disappointment and failure, is that you cannot have such a radical disconnect between what your international policy goals are and what actually occurs at home. And that is what at least the United States, and I would argue most countries around the world, including Europe, have had, this massive disconnect between, oh, we're going to save the world, and oh, we're going to have this agreement, and yet domestically, at least in the United States, the country I know best, literally doing almost no regulation of any greenhouse gas that I can see. And so when you have that disconnect, of course it's going to be failure. And so you're using the recent airline decision as a real-life example that's going to force people to the table. I agree with that. And I think what's also going to force people to the table is when countries actually begin to take action. Then the United States will have it in its interest to bring some commitments to the table if its industries are already having to do certain things. So that's where this interplay between what's happening domestically and what has been occurring internationally, we could eventually see some form of marriage. But between now and then, I see this idleness, Kevin, so I think we're just running in place.
And I think it'll be interesting to see how the U.S. does respond to the decision out of the EU, because will it respond with trade tools? You know, in the past with China and even with Japan, that's what its response has been. The U.S. has had the opportunity for two decades now or more to get out and lead in these markets, and instead of doing that, the way it's responded is to sit back, and then when other countries try to move forward and establish some sort of sustainable energy changes to their practices, the U.S. responds with trade tools. And this gets to your point about, was the U.S. proactive, was the U.S. sufficiently positive in Durban? You can't assess that in the absence of looking at the U.S.'s 20-year history of inaction. These questions about common but differentiated responsibilities, about equity between countries, wouldn't be nearly so relevant if the U.S. had taken the action 20 years ago that it said it was going to take 20 years ago. And so now here we are 20 years later with the biggest, what was the biggest historic emitter and what was for most of history the biggest actual emitter on the planet still having done nothing appreciable to show its leadership. And we're arguing about whether developing countries are doing enough on their part.
I think that's an interesting point to bring up, this common but differentiated responsibilities issue that's been permeating the conference since inception. I think we're at the point where those need to be rediscussed, those differences between nations. And the airline example is a perfect one. Europe says we're going to slap on this payment you have to pay to land or take off in our airports. And China says, oh, we're a developing country. We couldn't possibly do that. Hello, rich people fly in planes, not the 1.2 billion poor people that you're trying to save here. And it's the same with India and the end of the negotiations when they were going on and on about whether what it should be called, agreement with legal form. We can't put 1.2 billion people in poverty. It's not the 1.2 billion people in poverty that we're talking about. It's a rich poor is now not defined by a country. And I think that's one of the things that the U.S. actually managed to bring out in the discussion.
Absolutely. I think you're right, Lisa, and I think it's so helpful for this whole international negotiating process to break down the walls between Annex 1 and non-Annex 1, to start really recognizing the differences between your basic companies, your Brazil, India, China's, South Africa's, more advanced developing countries, and the host of countries that are really, really in a very, very fragile,
vulnerable state. Or the pieces of the population within those countries that are rich. It's not about the country anymore. The nation state is sort of the wrong actor to be talking about now, because the emissions are not coming from the nation as a whole. They're coming from the actions that cause emissions in the country.
It's an interesting question about how sovereignty relates to the actual socioeconomic activity and the disparities between classes within countries, and it's we could go back to talking about how this raises issues around the nation state model itself. Period.
I see a tiny hole to bring in something positive because we're trying to.
Yes, please. Positivity. Yes. It's the holidays.
So one thing about the Green Climate Fund is that it not necessarily explicitly, but it does allow for private sector participation. And the U.S., if you recall, in the negotiations was pushing for countries like China to say that they might contribute to the fund, and that's of course unheard of. Why would they take Chinese taxpayers' dollars to do that? Just like the U.S. probably wouldn't use any taxpayer dollars, and so they were fighting for private sector participation. Well, there's a blossoming private sector in a lot of these countries, Brazil, China, India, etc. So as long as private sector participation is allowed, then we can get past this nation state definition of people contributing their taxpayers' money into a fund that's going to then go to Burundi for climate assistance. And instead, it's the private sector, the businesses that are causing the pollution that can actually contribute to its mitigation.
Now, Wiley, Camco is a big developer for the California markets here in the United States. From your perspective, has Durban made any impact on the ways that people are looking at preparing for the launch of the compliance market next year?
It could have been worse. So looking on the positive side, I mean, we at least have some continuation for now of the CDM and the process and the commitment period under Kyoto. But, what we're really still fundamentally faced with is, as we were talking about, the fracturing of the approach of doing this at the national level, and you're seeing the rise of regional, provincial, or state-level activities. So to the extent that, those things are going to at least contribute to the whole dialogue, if not supersede it, perhaps, we're seeing a really big change, I think, in how we're approaching this problem. I still am a believer in trying to come up with some global solution to this issue. When you look at the facts, right, 2010 was the warmest year in modern history. 2011 was the warmest La Nina year, when we have colder waters in the Pacific that usually bring down temperatures by a tenth of a degree. Concentrations are going up faster than ever before. Nothing has changed. It's only gotten worse. And yet you just don't see that sense of urgency, certainly within the U.S.
What do you guys see as the common factor that might arise amongst the different mitigation commitments that countries are going to be preparing and rolling out in 2015? You hear a lot of folks saying, look, it's going to be let a thousand flowers bloom approach. There's not going to be one central global carbon market and so on. There's been a lot of discussion around the red issues, reducing emissions through degradation, deforestation. But do you guys see a common factor? Is it, per the discussion we just had about private capitals coming in, is it that public-private partnership? Is that going to be the common theme, not just tax dollars, not just government appropriations in a time of austerity, but more partnership with the private sector, at least in discussion? Is that going to be one of the themes? If not that, what, if any, would you see as a common theme among the mitigation commitments coming into 2015?
Chris, I'd like to take a whack at that, and that's a huge question and an important one, a very good one. I'm only going to try to answer a sliver of it because I think it raises a lot of issues that I'm curious what the other panelists think. But it goes back to what Lisa was talking about, and she was making, I think, a pretty powerful point that I agree with her up halfway, and then I want to draw her back, which is
half.
Well, but it raises really,
what you got a discount rate with Bill. Sorry.
Exactly. What is where is the Kyoto Protocol right now? What does an international agreement actually look like? None of us really know the answer to that. But it seems to me that drawing out the reality that from some of these developing countries, there are some very wealthy industries and wealthy people that are controlling these levers, I think is significant. And to me, the United States remains the microcosm of the global effort, because there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. It is going to have to be, and I'm just using some examples, retiring the very oldest and dirtiest of the coal-burning power plants, A. B, looking at methane reduction strategies that are cost-efficient. We know they're out there. C, some land use modifications in land use. And I'm just picking those three as big. There's others, of course. And I think that if those industries can be regulated and with cooperation and discussions, which arguably is already occurring in the United States, those types of deals then, I think, get quote-unquote codified at the international level. I think what's going to happen is as you begin to see this real-life regulation, real-life solutions occurring on the ground in a country like the United States, those are precisely the types of solutions that will be the centerpiece of whatever they decide to do in 2015 or 2020. That's why what this administration does over the next year and whatever occurs post-2012 is so important, not only for the United States, but for the rest of the globe. If we continue to do nothing, the rest of the world will continue to basically do nothing, is my sense.
But, Bill, we're actually not doing nothing. As you correctly point out, we have many flowers blooming. They don't all seem like flowers, and some of them certainly don't smell like it. AB 32 is the flower of note, and Reggie is, well, Reggie. But the April 3rd VOC NSPS for flowback methane, basically, is to get to the point of, if you look at how the EPA's rulemaking is proposed, it says, here, guys, you've got this flowback methane from the wellhead, a hotly disputed quantity and assured to be one that's litigated continuously, but it is a volatile organic compound that we regulate already for something else. But here's the deal. 630 of your wells will add up to a major source, and then you have to contend with GHG regulations. Otherwise, tackle it here through the flowback methane, get yourself a three-phase separator, get a dehydrator, go to work on it, and you have a fixed cost. When I look at the numbers EPA uses, which seem at least right now like they might be representative, we're talking about 18 to 25 cents per MCF, right? Taking that into sort of like a full-blown carbon cost, it's cheap. It's a fraction of the going rate of, you know, Exxon's $80 by 2040. And it's exactly the kind of thing that gives you an example of, again, how to put a price on it and to start make it collinear with the energy-producing interests that need to ultimately regulate their emissions for this to work. And it's happening.
The best climate policy in the U.S. is right now not climate policy, the impact climate policy. We look at it as climate policy. It's not done explicitly as climate policy, but it's done in furtherance of local air pollution,
energy efficiency,
cost control, you know, and so on. And, you know, the release yesterday of the maximum achievable control technology rule for toxics was an example of that. And, you know, you do have, as we've noted, some direct climate-focused initiatives that are happening, but all of it is really at the local level. I mean, we're back to the Federalist laboratory, you know, cooperative federalism, trying to evolve approaches up to the local level, and then you get up, and I think what I heard Bill say was that you're kind of going to get at it to a review and approval stage. And in some ways, if you look at the carbon markets with the EU ETS, that was what the EU selected to go through. You did have the flexibility mechanisms, you know, in the protocol, but there wasn't any hard and fast way to say this is the exact mechanism that you need to take, country, to get to this level of reductions, to meet your commitment. And it'll be interesting to see how that, you know, the fact that load is not growing in this country in terms of overall national electrical usage, that might stay that way with all the energy efficiency penetrated. We also have, you know, a gas pricing scenario that we have not seen in a long time, and that arguably is stronger than even the most bullish views of gas pricing in the early 90s.
When you're talking about those trends, you know, don't forget one thing, which is something else happened in 2010 last year, which is our emissions shot back up by 4%. Mm-hmm. That's a very high rate of growth. China and India both grew at 10% levels. The global economy may still be hurting in terms of jobs and employment, but in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, it's rising most recently faster than we've ever seen it.
Yeah, so I'm glad you keep
it's really important. I'm sorry to keep throwing out some big numbers.
No,
but, you
I'm really
know,
glad
but,
that you raised that, and I was nodding, but for the folks listening to this, I was nodding my head vigorously the last time he talked about that. But no, clearly from at least a carbon output point mm-hmm. of view or greenhouse pollutant point of view, the 2008-2009 recession retraction has ended.
It's over.
2010 was, I think, 5% greenhouse growth, and every indication is 2011 is going to be worse.
But China to go up 10% in 2010.
It's extremely disturbing. The Middle East countries are skyrocketing. No, the issue is at hand, for sure. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk about, Chris, because I thought you did a nice job there summarizing, bringing together that sort of non-carbon policy or the non-greenhouse gas policy that is taking shape. And I think yesterday's mercury coal toxic rule is a great example of that. But here's a somewhat rhetoric question to the other panelists. Why isn't the president talking about it in the terms you just did? I mean, it boggles my mind. Not that he's being tentative. That I understand. That's what Democrats do. They govern from the center, and they want everyone to be happy. That's Clintonian and fine. What he's not doing, I mean that in the Bill sense, not the Hillary sense, is, I know, is he has not yet articulated any path that I can see that anyone would want to follow him on. And it just, am I missing? Did he give the speech and I missed it?
He said there are many ways to skin that cat, remember?
Yeah. Well, I'm enlightened.
And do you think we'll see something pretty soon on a Keystone decision that would be an indicator where he's going?
Well, I don't know if he'll have to make
as a piece of red meat
because of congressional politics, but I do think that his inability to really articulate what's happening here is at least half the problem.
No, it is, and from a president who is arguably, one of the best, at least in the top five orators that we've had as presidents. There's a big question. I do want to pick up on something that Wiley just hit on the Keystone point, because I think it's interesting. From an absolute admissions view, which is one that we all have to revert to if we're going to be serious about the problem, Wiley's point on the Keystone pipeline, I'm curious about this group's view, and it goes to the political issues about what the president's saying, what he's not saying, that Bill's raising. From an admissions point of view, if we don't build the Keystone Pipeline south, and it builds west, as Canada is vehemently saying it's going to do, and it's clear from, the way that they reacted in Durban, some arguing pulling out in a way, in an environment of all vessels where they didn't, even if they didn't have the substance to fill it, they could have at least hung out in the vessel, but yet they pulled out. With that environment, I'm just curious, from an absolute view, what are the difference is, if Keystone doesn't come down to us and it goes west, is there a real differentiating impact in the amount of greenhouse gas emissions? Aren't the sands still supposed to be developed, and how does that play in politics?
If that idea that if we don't do it, someone else will,
I
is the classic
that.
Apologist's
yep,
excuse.
That.
And it assumes two things. It assumes first that it is easy for Canada to build that pipeline west to its western coast, where they have to deal with First Nations, which actually have some pretty substantial control of their lands. If it were easy to build that pipeline, Canada would have done it already. It also assumes that if they build Keystone, they're not going to also try to build the pipeline to go west and get to China. Mm-hmm. So for both of those reasons, that argument that if we don't import the tar sands oil, Canada or China will, is bogus, particularly given that the U.S. is also building its own capacity to export fossil fuels to China. You can't use the "we're saving the world from China burning tar sands fuels" as an excuse to build Keystone XL.
And you think, Carol, I'm assuming that the president should be saying it, just as you just did.
I think, and this is where I agree with Bill, you're right. We have a president who is a tremendous orator. What we've not seen is a president being a real leader on these issues. And we've seen time and time again that the opportunity has been there to do it, and we've just not been seeing it done. This is the irony here, is that Congress enforcing the executive's hand, if they were to actually force a decision on Keystone XL, might actually bring an end to the pipeline simply by forcing a decision before it can be properly taken.
Decision could be no.
Hamlet talked pretty, but couldn't make a decision. I think that if you look at the Keystone issue as a metonymy for sort of the environmental movement's new cause celeb, and I would be disappointed about environmentalism, because I don't think you'd want to pin your hopes for the green future on one pipeline when we need five. There's going to be five pipelines south, in the next 15 years to move Canadian oil sands capacity into this country. I don't think they'll go through the First Nations. I think they'll come here because, in addition to all the problems you mentioned, they'd be competing with Maya Sour, also a low-quality oil, and Arab Heavy, which comes out of the ground at single digits. And they'd be basically selling themselves to a monopsony buyer, China, whereas we have high-efficiency facilities to refine the stuff, and they can sell it for a higher price to us. So they may say a lot of things, but they really, 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 please, please, pretty please want to sell it here. The question, though, is what you do about a world where your crude supply is getting more and more emissions intensive. And it doesn't really matter where you do it. It's all getting more energy and emissions intensive. It's also becoming more water intensive. You're fracking shales. And all of these things are actually probably very closely aligned with everything that's been discussed in the broader climate initiative. Luckily, there's this great mechanism called the global price for oil. And I think it's going to settle a lot of these scores pretty quickly. 2008 showed us how quickly a market-based price can solve a consumption problem when people weren't respecting supply limits. We're headed back into that environment in 2015. Some of the messiest emissions-intensive growth you've talked about, the Middle East, for example, where they burn oil for heat and for power, which is an absolute travesty from every perspective, these are the places where the economic incentive should be bringing some of these developing nations, the least likely participants in the discussion, to the table. And if there's one thing Keystone does, it gives the Saudis some discipline on the issue. If there's a big abundant source stealing market share from them, they might start thinking about how to maximize their profit a little bit better. And efficiency and climate mitigation could be, in perhaps not direct, but unintended result. Bill, you look like you're either about to break out laughing at me.
No, it's just a classic Kevin and articulate, a mix of pragmatism and idealism. And it's hard to always rebut this because you weave them together so well. But I actually agree with all of that. And
this is getting weird.
Well, and let me tell you why I agree with it. I mean, we talk about Keystone in a second. Let me start with Keystone. Keystone is obviously very important on its own right, but it's also become very symbolic. We all know that. I mean, and so it is symbolic for a lot of issues that will be fought out over the coming months and years, which is not to belittle Keystone. It's just to say that just a lot of stars align to have that be the battle line, and it is what it is. But our goal, I think, in the environmental community, certainly at the Center for Biological Diversity and our allies, is to cut off the supply of fossil fuels in the areas that are most dangerous to extract them. And we've put our cards on the table on that. And the reason I agree with everything you just said, Kevin, is I actually think that can add to the predictability and to the supply levels of the pricing. We are putting on the table that we want to, in essence, if you restrict the amount of supply, we want the price to increase. And we think if the price of fossil fuels increase over time, and it becomes harder to invest in those forms of energy, that renewable forms of energy, green funds and Solandra aside, will do just fine on their own because they will finally be able to compete without the subsidies that we think fossil fuel extraction gets. So we haven't even talked about Arctic drilling. The administration, as it's fighting the Keystone fight, whatever that means, is giving away the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas right now, literally handing them over to the oil and gas industry, saying, here, drill here. And we've never drilled in those areas. So I just think it's a multi-pronged effort to beat back the fossil fuel folks. And Kevin,
are you going to stay home in the next election?
No, I'm going to vote for somebody.
I mean, MACT wasn't enough for you? Greenhouse gases as a pollutant wasn't enough for you?
But it's like that I live in the district. Were I to live in a place where my vote might count, no, I think there's serious issues of people in the progressive community about whether they will vote for Obama. And I think Keystone, again, has become a symbol of that, for right or for wrong.
And you think that your view isn't just, again, we're all beltway myopic, but that's representative.
I think it's representative that a president seems to stand for nothing and that he seems to be just weebling and wobbling and the wind just sort of blows him where it blows him, and he's not the guy who's going to defend those values. Now, he can change a lot in the next year, and the House Republicans can continue to screw up things the way that they seemingly are screwing things up. So who knows what will happen? But no, this is very different than the way President Clinton was. President Clinton did some things that made the left and the progressive very angry at him, but then he always picked a fight or two that you knew he was going to fight to the death on. Obama does all those deals and then doesn't pick the fights that he's going to fight. He does none of that. So
is that asking for perfect at the enemy of good in this political environment in times of austerity, given where we sit?
It's asking for a comrade in battle, and the president just doesn't ever seem to be there. Now, of course, you know, I'm sure he thinks he is fighting these fights, but from my vantage point, I don't see it.
An alternative takes time to build. I mean, one of the biggest problems with third political parties in this country has been getting the structure, the party structure, the base up, organizing and going. There is not a significant, or at least not that I've heard of, emphasis swelling amongst the Green Party or other third,
who's
more progressive parties.
Who's talking about third parties? Who's to say Mitt Romney? Who's to say Mitt Romney couldn't do these climate deals better than the president, this the current president? I at this point in time, he couldn't do much worse. And I think Romney, ironically, maybe could bring together some of these thoughts that we've been talking about today into some sort of cogent path that the American people would follow.
Yeah, he could flip back to favoring cap and trade like he did before.
He clearly will flip. It's just where he ends up flopping upon. And I do think that the Republicans, if they were, I mean, there's a lot of things that terrify me about the Republicans governing. But I think the House Republican leadership is, you know, off the deep end. But Romney is an example of someone who maybe that, you know, only Nixon could go to China. Maybe only a president like Romney can deliver climate policy. I don't know.
David Cameron, for example.
If assuming that Romney changes his mind again and agrees that man-made climate change exists and we're responsible for it. So that would be a start.
Yeah.
You know, I think part of what Bill is speaking to, and part of what you were talking about earlier in terms of the federalist system and the federal experimentation going on, the laboratory system that works so well in policy in the U.S., is something that you're seeing on the environmental movement side as well. I mean, even we started this conversation talking about Durban, and my organization has been working to make climate policy work at the global level for its entire 20-year existence. What we are seeing now is that there's enough in Durban to give us hope to keep working on that system, but at the same time, we can no longer wait. And what you're seeing in the environmental community is the battles, not just against one pipeline, not just against Keystone, but against coal plants, against for the mackerel, for mercury. So even as policymakers are trying that laboratory approach, so are we in the environmental community, and it really is a by any means necessary approach to bring down carbon emissions wherever we can. And what we are finding on mercury rules and elsewhere is that, you know, many of these things have really important co-benefits for human health, for communities, for other aspects of the environment, whether it's water quality or property owner rights. And so we are finding more and more allies in that. And I think this is what you're going to see in response to Durban is a continued period of absolute thousand flowers on the environmental side.
And one of the biggest challenges that the thousand flowers approach always brings is the question of measurement, benchmarking, monitoring, verification. If you're going to have a multitude of different mitigation tracks, how do you gauge all of them against a similar metric to say ultimately that commitment was met? That is a tremendous challenge, even here in the United States.
But we've never had better international reporting on greenhouse gas emissions and the contributors to that, all the agricultural and the energy and other statistics that drive those. That's been a huge success. I mean, if there's one thing we've gotten out of UNFCCC is every April 15, all the developed countries report annually their emissions, and developing countries on a periodic basis, and it's formed an amazingly consistent and comparable and relatively accurate database on which to track progress, as you said. So we can track it at the aggregate level. We just can't track it at the small level where things are.
It's a vote for continuing with the absolute. Everything has to ultimately end there.
Or at least that's your final gauge. Because the atmosphere, at the end of the day, it's what's the total flux, right?
Well,
and we're seeing it increasing.
The one wacky thing that I want to leave this hour with, and it's building upon that comment, is, the Clean Air Act not only has this creative federalism where the states can implement these federal standards, and we've been talking a lot about that this morning, but it also has a device by which the federal government go out and reach out to other foreign governments about pollution that the United States is emitting that harms those other countries. It doesn't have to just be Canada, Mexico. It could be any country in the world. And it strikes me that if you buy, this is Section 115 of the Clean Air Act, if you buy the notion that internationally, whatever will occur internationally is going to be essentially a codification, a coming together of what countries have already done, why not use that authority of the Clean Air Act to do how we do trade agreements? Which is, we don't do trade agreements but it just all of a sudden lands on a table. Big multilateral trade agreements occur because we've had these individual bilateral and multilaterals that build up enough momentum into this overarching agenda. And so I think that's the way you, if you negotiate these clean air agreements with other countries, you verify emissions, you verify legal regimes, you verify a lot of relationships, and you move ahead that way. And if this administration or any were really serious about reducing greenhouse pollution, they'd use that authority.
It's interesting because the if you look at where the transport rule now, the cross-state air pollution rule, it's a 126 action. It was a cross-border action, a layer down from the state sovereignty issue, but amongst the United States, a U.S. state to U.S. state issue. It'll be interesting to see if that cross-border issue picks up, and there is increasing talk around other mechanisms like the Commission on Environmental Cooperation under NAFTA and other trade agreements that has a broader grant than a lot of people look. And it's an interesting theme that I'm hearing in D.C. now, and it's one that often comes with legislative gridlock on a number of issues where you're having EPA go back and, over the course of the last year or so say, look, there's a lot more authority under the Clean Air Act that we haven't touched yet. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, has come and said, look, there's a lot more authority under the Federal Power Act than we've tapped in the past, and we might do it. If you look at the latest action on discriminatory tariffs and transmission access up in the Northwest, it's the first time FERC used that section, and so on. And you've seen the same theme go. And so it'll be interesting to see if that's how things move. Before we wrap up, I want to ask the panel one last question, and that is it an accurate statement to say that the themes of the time weave through all things? We just finished a super committee process here where we had Congress agree on that we're going to agree how we're going to agree, and when we agree, it's going to be binding if we agree at that point in time. Well, I mean, there's a certain principle in legislative process called last in time has the most significance, and so on. You can change what came before. Are we entering a super committee type process internationally? Are we setting ourselves up for the same type of thing that we did with the super committee here in the United States? A few more years to it, yes, but is it the same type of thing? And the other aspect of the question I'll ask on the concept of commonality is we've had a lot of discussions here in the United States about green banks, about the Clean Energy Development Authority, and so on. All these aspects about what kind of structures that had aims not too dissimilar to what the Global Climate Fund is looking at, and so on. But in times of austerity, you always hit the wall on capitalization. The same wall that Lisa was describing was, I think, recognized, you may say not hit, but they at least aimed the car towards it. Do you guys see the same commonality happening internationally that's happening here in the United States?
Chris, you're supposed to be positive. You just said that the Durbin process is going to end as badly as the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction.
I did not say that because it's the holidays okay. And we're happy.
Well, let me offer, I think that what happens, I'm going to go back to an earlier era of moderate Republicans, not the Romneys, but the Scowcrofts. And the Scowcroftian view of the Middle East is essentially just wait. The youth will eventually grow into maturity, take leadership roles, and the fundamentalists will be they'll be extincted by their own aging process.
Can't hold back the tide of information.
And so, what happens, all the flowers that are blooming now, whether they be here or elsewhere, are effectively useful if there's a framework still going where they can be discussed later. So unlike the JSC, which was a bounded one-shot event with a doomsday device, the UNFCCC is still there, and there is still a forum going on. Global trade, and let's hope this doesn't change, is still happening, and there's still a price moving across borders. And so what I would say is that in terms of what's weaving through all things, protectionism and isolationism are weaving through all things, true. And if that can be stopped, then we're actually on the path. We're on the pathway where if we just wait, I think this starts to converge back in a few years.
Said like a true economist. Bill, did Dermid super committee to the climate treaty process?
I think so. Certainly in terms of its inability to actually speak to the small p people's needs. I think, you know, we just keep kicking it to a higher level that means that no decision is made. I could agree with what Kevin just said as a matter of government governance and international governments and policy if we were not looking down the barrel at such severe impacts from climate change in a time period that may be faster than that. That's the issue. And that's why I think the U.S. is going to have to exert some leadership, as short-term painful as it might be.
Yeah. And to Kevin's point, the markets need to signal and price those impacts to be able to begin to change. Is scarcity pricing alone enough? I mean, back to the old axiom, if we wait to get rid of, you know, to be on the downward slope off peak oil, we've already done too much. Lisa, you raised the capitalization issue. Do you see that same theme here? And, you know, Point Carbon obviously does a lot of work in the markets. Do you see anything in Durbin significantly fixing that capitalization issue? Is at least the groundwork laid to get there?
Our view has been at Point Carbon, Thomson Reuters, that the entire framework convention matters less and less as we go to markets, at least. Markets are going to figure themselves out. They're going to be regional markets that perhaps interconnect globally and have some impact on the UNFCCC decisions in the long run. An example is California. You mentioned AB 32. They're going ahead with it. Quebec has now actually adopted some regulations, so it's going to be a wider Western Climate Initiative market. And RED credits, whatever they turn out being, are going to be allowed for compliance in that program. So there you go. There's a connection to the international scene. We're not really sure if and when there will ever be any RED credits, but there is a way for markets to actually interlink and help some of this reduction process get going, despite the fact that there is no particular international agreement. The problem where I would disagree with Kevin is we don't have any more time. You were saying wait and time will heal all wounds, but as Wiley's been saying the whole time, we ain't got no more time. It's all, I mean, we're already seeing the effects of climate change now, so I think markets are unfortunately a bit too slow.
Carol, what's your view on this? You noted the federalism concept. We have a lot going on at the municipal, the state level, the county level here in the United States. They're charting that same course internationally. Let 1,000 flowers bloom as long as we all kind of fall under that umbrella. Do you think there's significant disconnects when that model that has worked here on other issues and other places and other issues is exported up to the international level?
Well, first I'd say I agree with Lisa, you know, that Kevin's just wait approach is good, but for the fact that we're out of time to wait. In terms of the models that we can use, you said it yourself that agencies are exploring powers that they have in existing laws in new and creative ways, and I think that we're going to see that on the domestic level. I think we're going to see that on the international level in terms of very creative advocacy. I'd say, you know, if we compare what's going on in the UNFCCC to what, you know, to the Joint Select Committee, I think to me the common denominator there is dysfunction in U.S. politics playing a role in both. So I think it's, you're comparing two very related things. And to me, this is precisely why we're going to be looking at very creative uses of law to move this process forward when the politics keeps breaking down.
Wiley, CAMCO is as a facilitator of reductions. You're a project developer, project finance in the carbon offset space. From that on-the-ground perspective of getting a project developed, financed, getting folks to sign on in the NADA commitments that it takes to move a carbon project forward, did Durbin do anything to make your life easier?
Well, of course, the problem was the market already crashed before Durbin, but it kept a light on at the CDM and ETS for a little bit longer. 1,000 flowers bloom, but they bloom in a live or die compliance regime. It's not voluntary for them to open up their flowers. It's mandatory. We'll never get there voluntarily. Those 1,000 flowers bloom under law, right? Law of survival. And in our case, we need 1,000 flowers blooming under some kind of compliance regime, or no one's going to spend money investing into a voluntary market.
Well, that's challenges in times of austerity, and we heard a lot of the similar themes. Agree to agree about how we're going to agree in the future if we agree. Protectionism, but also going back to trying what ultimately can work. And I think, if anything, world is going to be getting more diverse, not less, in the future. And with that, thanks for joining us in the heat. We'll see you next time on the Hot Air Show.